we all know that space is the final frontier. And I can remember Captain James T. Kirk on his 5-year mission to explore strange new worlds and seek out life. If only he'd known to stop off at the University of Oxford in the UK, where there's the team that runs the public website Galaxy Zoo, and what they're doing is using internet-scale collaboration in order to allow participants from the general public to help classify galaxies. These guys could have given Captain Kirk a map, and he could have had the whole trip done in less than 3 months. Now, the Starship Enterprise was in for a service that day, and Captain Kirk doesn't like to take it out in the rain anyway, so we stopped off to chat to the Galaxy Zoo team on his behalf.
Okay, so I'm here with Chris. Chris, would you like to introduce yourself for the camera, say who you are and what you do here?
Sure. My name's Chris Lintott. I'm an astronomer here at the University of Oxford. And my role these days is to run a whole suite of citizen science projects, projects that get the public involved in the research that we do, not just as spectators, but as necessary participants in the science as well.
So this term of citizen science is kind of new to me. What is that? Can you sort of elaborate a bit on citizen science?
Yeah, it's a new idea, or a new name for a very old idea. So actually, when you think of a scientist, you imagine the guy in his white coat with a bubbling test tube of something, or people like me sitting in an office at a computer. But the idea of professional scientists is a 20th century invention. If you go all further back than that, particularly in my subject, astronomy, you find that science is done by volunteers, by amateurs. In the 19th century, the 18th century, they're rich men, usually in the UK, who've made their money. People like William Herschel, who was a professional musician, built telescopes and discovered Uranus in his spare time. So this tradition of people choosing to participate in science. And then as science got bigger, as it became more professional, as you needed to build big observatories, not in a garden in Bath, like Herschel did, but on the Canary Islands or in Hawaii, you need teams of people at universities. And so really what we're doing goes back to those early days to try and get anyone, people with no science background, people just sitting down for 20 seconds, a few minutes in front of their computer, to be able to contribute something to learning about the universe. And we call that process citizen science.
So you're kind of taking a traditional approach, what was the long-standing approach, and applying the internet to it.
That's right, which means that we can reach many more people. So instead of just rich old men, anyone can take part. And that's actually crucial, because scientists are facing a universal problem. Astronomers, ecologists, anyone you can think of has really too much data. For most of the last 30 to 40 years, the amount of data that we can get has constrained the science that we can do. So in astronomy, you can only learn so much by looking at 100 galaxies. So we build a new telescope, or we do a new survey, and we get thousands of galaxies. And then you move forward. But cameras have become cheap, bandwidth has become cheap, storage is reasonably cheap. And so suddenly we're facing a world now where, instead of having 1,000 galaxies, where, you know, if you have 1,000, you can set a student that task to look at those. If you only have 100, that's a professor's task. But suddenly we've got 1,000,000. And we need to work out what to do with 1,000,000 galaxies. And one solution to that is to vastly increase the number of people involved. And we can do that via the web by sharing these galaxies with everybody.
And so I know that the websites that we're talking about today have been focused on data out of a particular survey, which I think is the Sloan survey.
That's right.
Is that right? Can you explain a little bit of background around
Sure.
what that survey was and what data comes out of it?
So the Sloan Digital Sky Survey is a remarkable project. It changed astronomy because it changed the way that we do things. So it started, I hope I'm not going to offend them by telling the story, but it's, you know, the sociology is that it's a bunch of particle physicists at Fermilab who wanted to get into astronomy because there are various problems that you can solve by looking at the universe that tell you about the science of the very small. And so they built an observatory with a lot of collaborators, as you would as a particle physicist. In other words, they went and built an experiment. So I'm used to spending my time applying for small numbers of hours on telescopes. I might spend a month writing a proposal to get 10 hours on the Hubble Space Telescope. And then it points to where I tell it, it does what I tell it to do, and I get my data, and that's a year's worth of work to publish that. Whereas, from a particle physics point of view, the solution was to have one telescope that scanned the sky, that produced a huge amount of data, and then you could put that on the web, and you can distribute it, and you can share that information. So there were specific things they were after, but equally, what they will have done was record the position and velocity. So, sorry, the position and distance of 1,000,000 galaxies.
Right.
And so we have an image for each of those galaxies. And you can do anything you like with that. You can study galaxy formation. you can look at what types of galaxies exist in the universe, or you can use them to tell you about the evolution of the universe as a whole. But rather than try and insist that they knew what they were doing it for, take the data, put it out on the web. And that's the data that was sitting there when I came to Oxford.
And so you've got a vast amount of data there coming out of that survey. Is this something that you just point a bunch of CPUs at and say, hey, pattern recognition, what's that?
Well, that's one plan. That's one way of dealing with it. Because what my part of this story is to try and understand galaxy formation. So how did we get the mix of galaxies that we see today? And we do that by a form of archaeology. You see what you've got, and then you see what that tells you about how it got there. So to do that, the first step is to sort the galaxies out into their shapes. So galaxies come in two types. They're spirals and ellipticals, in very broadly speaking. And the difference is as fundamental as if you're a medical doctor trying to understand the health of the population of Britain. You need to understand that humans come in two types, right. Male and female, and they'll have different behaviours and different histories and different things wrong with them. And it's as fundamental as that difference. And traditionally, you used to look at the galaxies and classify them. And people published big atlases of 100 or so galaxies classified by Professor whoever. You know, and that was the definitive guide. When we got to the 80s and we got thousands of galaxies, we had to give... The solution was just to give the galaxies to students, and people would make their thesis out of looking at hundreds of galaxies. Right. When I came here, I met a guy called Kevin Stravinsky, who was then finishing his doctoral degree, his PhD, and he'd looked at 50,000 galaxies.
Right.
Okay. And the first result of Kevin's thesis was, when you've seen 50,000 galaxies, you're not going to look at any other more anymore, no matter how important that is. Right. And so as I was working with Kevin, it became clear we needed to look at the other 950,000. And Kevin, over a pint in the pub, told me where I could stick the other 950,000. And because we knew of other internet projects that were using the public to look at data, particularly there's a NASA one called Stardust at Home, which has people looking at dust grains. Mm-hmm. Dust grains that were brought back from a comet, but still dust grains.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, if people will look at dust grains, surely they'll look at galaxies. And so that's where the idea for Galaxy Zoo, which was our first project, was born.
And it is that people are better, you're better off using the computers to store the data and put the data in front of people.
Yeah.
You can't just quickly build a computer system that says this type of galaxy or that type of galaxy. Humans do that a lot better.
Yeah, well, what's interesting is that people had tried, so there'd been a long diversion through people using computer systems to do this. And they get most of the answers right most of the time. But the problem from a science point of view is that the ones they get wrong aren't uniform. It's not random. Right. Like, it's not that they get every fifth galaxy wrong. It's that they get the red ones wrong, or the small ones wrong, or the interacting ones. Mm-hmm. And that biases your results.
Okay.
So the results are better by getting not just a human to do it, but a large number of people. Because if we can have 50 people look at the same set of galaxies, we can say something about how easy that classification was. If 50 people out of 50 agree, you can be fairly certain that's a spiral. If only 25 out of 50 say it's one thing, then that's a different category of thing. It's much harder. That information turns out to be useful.
Yeah, so if we think about the specific websites that we've seen... We had Galaxy Zoo as, I think, the original. What was Galaxy Zoo then, and how did it relate to that set of images that came back from the Sloan survey?
Well, Galaxy Zoo was saving Kevin's bacon. So taking the million galaxies we had from Sloan and asking the simplest useful question. So is it a spiral? If it's a spiral, which way are the arms turning? And if not, is it an elliptical, is it a star, or is it a merging galaxy? So six buttons... Click a button, you get the next galaxy.
So a million galaxies.
That's right.
And six buttons.
That's right.
And how many people did you get to contribute to?
In
to
total,
that
we ended up with just shy of 200,000 people.
Wow.
And they did about 100 million classifications in all. So we had very good information by the end on each galaxy. So not only did we know the answer, but we knew how confident we were about the answer. And all sorts of amazing things came from that survey.
And so they weren't just classifying each... It's not that everybody classifies each galaxy once. You get...
Yeah, well, you may turn up and do 100. Somebody else may... There were people who went through the whole set. But yes, you use multiple classifications on each galaxy. And then you use the wisdom of the crowd. You take an average or you take a weighted average. You could do some interesting statistical trickery to draw out the right answers. But nonetheless, you get your average answer. And that's more accurate than just having Kevin do it. No offence to Kevin, he's actually pretty good, but you get a better answer from having a large number of volunteers than of having a single astronomer.
And so you ran that million classifications. When did this run? What was the time?
So we launched in July 2007, at which point our server melted.
Yeah.
We were back online 8 hours later, thanks to our team at Johns Hopkins, who somehow had a spare server sitting under the desk that they were waiting to install. So unbelievably, they got us back online, and then we ran till roughly February this year, 2009.
Wow, okay. So
it was online for a while, yeah. Partly because we were scrambling to keep up with people and with the results. So we found all sorts of things. So we found a whole set of red spiral galaxies that no one suspected were as numerous or as populous as we found. Most spiral galaxies are blue, and we're trying to explain them. But one of the nice things is people are also good at making serendipitous discoveries. Mm-hmm. If you show an image to somebody, show an image to a computer, it will do the task that you ask it to do and move on. You show an image to somebody, they'll also look round and they'll discover the weird stuff. And so we've just had a beautiful example of this. There are a whole set of small, round, green objects in the background of some of the images. No one paid them any attention. And these, our users found them. They called them the Galaxy Zoo Peas,
right,
because they're small, round, and green.
Right.
And these turn out to be the most efficient sites of star formation anywhere in the local universe. Oh. And why these small galaxies are suddenly bursting into life, we've no idea. But right now, one of my colleagues is on a mountaintop in Chile trying to trace down the history of these things and trying to work out what's happening. So we're redirecting some of the world's professional telescopes because somebody sitting at home saw one of the green things in the background and, more importantly, asked, what is that? And that's the human element of this. It's this ability to go, hang on, what's that in the corner?
And so as you were navigating through that UI on the original Galaxy Zoo, there was some kind of button for... There's some weird stuff in here.
Oh, actually, on the original Galaxy Zoo, there wasn't.
Okay.
There should have been, but we had a forum. And this all came out of a remarkable community that grew up on a forum. And the forum came about as an afterthought. We got 30,000 emails the first day, mostly from people telling us our site was down.
Yeah.
But once we got the site back up, we were still getting email from people saying, what's this? And you know, have you spotted this object? And so we joked we needed Email Zoo, which is a site where people answer emails for us. And then we realised that's a forum. And so we have this remarkable community of people on the forum who have become experts and are able to answer questions and are able to point us towards interesting stuff.
Right, okay.
So where the really unusual bubbles to the top, we tend to get a call or an email and say, right, come and have a look at this.
Okay.
And that works really well. It's even got to a stage where people on the forum are doing their own research. So we provide access not just to the image, but once you've classified a galaxy, you can click through and get the professional's interface. So you get measurements, the spectra, the detail about the galaxy. People have used that for all sorts of things. Some silly. We have a font written in galaxies now, which is fantastic.
Right.
But some very serious. There are users looking at irregular galaxies, small blobby things that we said weren't important, were rescued by a group of users who are now writing the definitive paper on irregular galaxies in Galaxy Zoo.
And so when you come to the end of that process, you know, you've built up this big community, they've got very involved online in classification, and then as is going to happen, that project kind of comes to an end.
Yeah.
What do you do?
Well, luckily we've got more work for them to do.
So
we launched Zoo 2 in February, which was a much more robust platform, so we survived our launch, which was great. Zoo 2 took 250,000 of the brightest galaxies from the sample, the brightest and therefore the most interesting.
Right.
And instead of asking one question, we asked lots. You follow a decision tree. So if the galaxy's got spiral arms, then tell us how many there are and tell us how tightly wound they are. Each piece of information tells us something about what's happened to that galaxy to get it to where it is today.
Mm-hmm.
So these are much more detailed classifications. The results look excellent. We've had just over 45 million classifications since February from and what's now a total community, including the Zoo 1 people, of about 250,000 people have participated. Wow. And so we can now really get into the nitty-gritty of these galaxies and start trying to understand what's going on.
So the kind of two things that happen with Zoo 2, one is around taking that initial classification and zooming in slightly. I mean, it's
That's
still
right.
a massive data set and a massive set of classifications.
Sure.
And also you got a chance to re-platform and get...
And we needed that. We finally decided that programming this... I mean, the original site was good for what it was, but it was a one-off website. But we thought we'd get 1,000 people in the first day, and then maybe another 1,000 the next week. And we were on a different scale to that.
Yeah.
So we needed some understanding of how the web works. You need some understanding of modern technology to support this. And building a flexible platform that we hope will let us support other projects, because we've got yet more work for people to do. In astronomy, we've got the entire Hubble Space Telescope archive will be the next thing, because that will allow us to trace the history in time. At the minute, we're looking at a snapshot of the local universe with Sloan. We want to know what the mix of galaxies looked like 3 billion years ago, 6 billion years ago in the universe. So we'll need to support that data set and do more complicated things, like we have a project with people simulating galaxy mergers, collisions between galaxies. So
right.
We can now run the simulation on people's own laptops in the browser, and then they match the simulation to a target galaxy and even
right.
take control of it. So that turns out to be very useful. And these more complicated interactions that involve fewer people, but still thousands,
yeah.
Need a more robust support than we can provide with our single-purpose website.
Okay, cool. So I think we're going to take a look around the website and we're going to talk technology and see how those things are put together. So I guess the natural question would be, having zoomed into that data, will there be a Zoo 3 and what would that look like?
Well, Zoo 3 is a whole host of things,
okay,
really. So we talked a little about the future of the astronomy section. We've got more galaxies,
mm-hmm.
so that's good. But it turns out, as I said right in the beginning, this is a problem that's shared amongst lots of science. And so we're building something we call the Zooniverse, which is a whole
right.
universe of zoo projects, which will host a whole host, why not, of these projects.
Yeah.
So, for example, we're working with NASA to deal with planetary science. So NASA have a spacecraft called the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which is in orbit around the moon now. It's taken some amazing images already. You might have seen the ones of the Apollo landing sites.
Mm-hmm.
Where you can actually see the one I saw today of Apollo 11, you can not just see the lunar landing module, but you can see the four pads, and you can see the flag in one of these images,
right.
or at least the shadow of the flag.
Uh-huh.
So it gives you an idea of the resolution.
Yeah, sure.
But this thing sends back, remember I said bandwidth is cheap, so this thing sends back 60 to 80 gigabytes of image data a day.
Right.
So even if all the planetary scientists in the world dropped everything else and looked at those images, they wouldn't be able to examine them in their
sure.
full resolution. So we're going to do that for them.
Okay.
So we'll have a lunar project which is about to go into beta testing,
okay.
where people will explore the lunar surface, classifying craters, keeping an eye out for the bizarre things, helping us work out whether all sorts of things about the structure of the moon. In ecology, if you wanted to study animal behaviour in the wild, you used to put one camera there and sit behind it and wait and see what happened. You can now cover a forest in webcams, but then you need people to watch that. So we're going to have that online. You can imagine bird's nest cameras, but you need to record the behaviour. We've even got a project looking at ancient papyri from Egypt. There are could be as many as 6 million fragments excavated from an ancient Greek city in what's now Egypt, 100 years ago, and brought here to Oxford, where a team at the classics department had been very slowly, very carefully going through the pile. We've no idea what's in most of it.
Right.
It could be anything, and we're going to help use people online to help decipher those papyri. So each of these is a very different science case.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same problem, and it's the same solution. Too much data, recruit more people to help.
Yeah, and you've got the platform in place in order to make that happen.
That's the idea.
Okay, let's go take a look at the platform and see how that's put together. All right, so we've wandered down the corridor, and we've routed out Arvin. Would you like to introduce yourself for the camera?
Yeah, so my name's Arvin Smith. And I'm the technical lead for Galaxy Zoo and the Zooniverse, and I work here in Oxford with Chris.
And what's your background? Are you a dedicated software engineer? Is that where you've come from in the past, or are you more of an astronomer?
Like Chris, actually, strangely, we're both astrochemists by trade, so we're both PhD astronomers. And my background is one of, like lots of astronomy PhD students do some programming during your studies, and then you sort of actually realise that maybe programming is more fun than astronomy. Well, in my case...
Yeah, we knew that all along.
Yeah, exactly. So I've sort of picked up the sort of web development side of things during my PhD, and then actually decided that that was where I wanted to head. So sort of in the last 4 or 5 years, I've been working mainly as a web developer. It's sort of new media agencies, and then more recently I worked at the Old Human Genome Project, the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute, building tools for scientific workflows there. So kind of software for science is kind of where I'm in, the sort of that's where I like to be.
And so how long have you been associated with the Galaxy Zoo project? How long have you been working?
So I've been on the project now for about 11 months.
Right.
So I joined in the new year.
Okay, so we talked to Chris about the aims of the project and the scale of the project and how we've gone through iterations from Galaxy Zoo through to Galaxy Zoo 2.
Mm-hmm.
What we've not really done is talked about any of the sort of software technology that's living behind this and obviously making it work.
Yep.
Could you give us a picture as to what you've had to do in order to build, I know you kind of build a platform for these kinds of applications.
Sure.
And how that's looked across the sort of iterations, because I know there's been changes as you've gone from sort of version one to where we are today.
Definitely. So the original Galaxy Zoo was really, I think I would call it a website that was built for a specific project. It served us very well, but there was no expectation that there would be more.
Right.
We'll build this site, and then if we're lucky, some people will come along and look at our galaxies, and then we'll look at the results.
And they came along.
And they did. And this was actually one of the main problems, that when we first launched, it was on a shared host, so this was one of many websites running on a relatively small server.
Right.
Linked to on BBC front page, and within about 2 hours of the project launching, the server hardware failed, basically.
Right.
We were very lucky that the science team and server team at Johns Hopkins University built us a new web server, and the project was live again within about 3 hours. And then that was, the story goes on from there. So
this wasn't something that you built, the first version? It was something you inherited?
No, the first version of the site was built for free for us by some of the kind folk at Johns Hopkins, basically.
Right.
And so that was because of their sort of background and their platform that they built on, so that was all in web forms and SP.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so you then took, realizing that you needed to do a much larger thing, and this was really a big engineering piece of work you've got to do.
Sure.
You moved that onto another iteration, which is really your current iteration.
It is. So there were a couple of things that we knew we wanted to do with Galaxy Zoo 2, and that was start working towards a more general software stack for different science projects. So
not just for Galaxy.
Not just for Galaxies.
Lots of citizens.
Yeah, we've got
projects.
A project coming with the moon in the future, and there's we've got a list of projects that we want to do, and very few of them to do with galaxies anymore,
right,
as it turns out. So we've got all these people and all these worthy projects, and so it was very clear when I joined that Galaxy Zoo 2 was going to be the first of a new breed of projects for us,
right.
And that meant a new approach to our sort of server infrastructure and also to the software that was running. And so sort of actually starting to talk about this in terms of software in a web environment, obviously, but software rather than just websites.
Yeah.
And so sort of start changing the conversation a little bit and people thinking about that.
And so when I'm sitting in front of the web UI today and I'm working on, a project like Galaxy Zoo 2,
yeah.
What have you got behind that, running that? What is that website? What is the back end behind that?
Yeah, so the Galaxy Zoo website is basically a thin client that speaks to a RESTful API.
Okay.
And both of those are actually built in Ruby on Rails.
Okay, so it's like a Ruby front end onto a Ruby API back end.
Yes, it is. And so that's the sort of software stack. So the API traffic is XML.
Mm-hmm.
Basically between the website and the API. And also the actual server infrastructure is Amazon Web Services. So
okay,
we've got,
so...
We've got basically a three-tier, a pretty typical API layer that can scale out based on load, talking to a database, and then a web layer that can scale out as well, so load-balanced web and API nodes, basically.
So you took away that problem of buying the one box hosted solution and finding out you need 1,500 boxes or whatever it might be.
Sure, yeah.
You took that by moving down the cloud route of let's let somebody else deal with provisioning the right infrastructure.
Yeah, provisioning and just the cloud platforms offer this a very attractive price model for us. You do your big launch, you get 200,000 people visit you on your first day, and you run 12 web servers that day, or however many you need. But actually, it only costs you $30 or something. You know, some ridiculously small amount, because 2 days later you've dropped down to 4 servers or something. So the kind of pricing model of those sorts of vendors is very good for a project like ours, where there aren't necessarily huge amounts of money to splash out on hardware. And also, who wants to be managing your own network? So, I mean, there's lots of stuff that we just don't want the overhead of managing.
Yeah, so I guess otherwise you would have to pay for the hardware to support your peak load.
Exactly.
That's not your usual
load. No, exactly. And you know, the difference between peaks, especially when you do a media launch, I mean, it's tenfold at least, and probably more, probably. I would say our peak, our largest traffic spike ever, which was when we were on, you know, breakfast sofa with on BBC and on large web launch as well, probably 20 or 30 times higher load than when we email all of our community. And we've got a lot of people that we can email. And so those spikes are just too big to pay for, basically, in old money, you know, with the actual hardware.
Sure. So, I mean, that's where you are right now. That's what's powering what we're looking at on the screen.
Yes.
But I know you're looking at changing some of the pieces of this, specifically around the back end.
Sure.
So can you lead us through how you came to be even thinking about changing and why you're looking at things like Windows Azure as a back end for this software?
So we were, as part of our sort of ongoing research that coming out of the science results that are coming out of the project, we were visiting Microsoft and we gave a talk at Redmond. And we were sort of just talking about the science goals of the project, but also our hosting environment. And we met up with some of the Microsoft folk who were basically highlighted, I guess, some of the differences between Windows Azure and Amazon Web Services. And specifically, the focus is more on the application that you're trying to run rather than managing all of the environment in which it sits. So you want to run a database, but maybe you don't want to have to run a machine that has MySQL installed or something. You just want a database of, you know, 10 gig capacity or something.
So who manages that in the existing system? Who manages these virtual servers that you have?
So this is a responsibility of mine and a couple of other people on the team. But, you know, we're a small team, especially in development size, of about, well, between 3 and 5 people, but full-time, too.
Yeah.
And so if 20% of my time is spent, you know, restarting MySQL instances or something, that's too much already.
Right. So you're kind of moving from the place where you get a cloud-hosted server to a cloud-hosted service, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's, especially for a small team, I think that's a better approach, for sure. Yeah. Allow you to sort of focus on the development and what your application's going to do and just making deployment easy. I think that's another thing, because deployment is, you know, something that you have to get right, especially when you have peaks and troughs in your traffic, and being able to respond in pretty near real time to provisioning new servers and provisioning scale, basically scaling up, is something you have to be ready to sort of learn about and get good at.
Right.
And I think what we have at the moment is we've got a pretty good tuned stack, but there is an overhead of managing the fundamental servers that they run on.
Right, and you just want that overhead to go away.
Well, ideally, yeah.
who wouldn't?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so that's kind of why you're looking at Azure.
Sure.
And where are you at right now in terms of looking at that stuff?
So we now have a port of our Rails application running on Azure today.
And so is that a Rails application running up at Azure?
No, so that's ASP.NET MVC2 port of our Rails application. And this was a demonstration, really, I think, of the sort of technologies, Microsoft technologies, to us, really, from some of the Microsoft folks. So demonstrating how you would re-implement some of the stuff we have in a different environment. And that's been really interesting, actually.
And has that been a sort of like-for-like port? So you had some Rails. Is it the Rails API that you had is now an MVC-based API?
Yes, yeah, exactly that. Okay. So we've now got we haven't actually done it, but I would say, days away from being able to point the front end website to a NBC port.
Cool.
And actually not having to make any code changes to the website, which is pretty amazing. Yeah, well, probably, that's probably not true, but we'll find out. But functionally, you know, like XML responses that come back are basically identical, and that's non-trivial, especially if you think about the way that that some of the REST toolkits in the ASP.NET framework, compared to just native serializing of a Ruby object, they actually just look different.
Yeah.
The XML is structured differently, and you know, so you know, caring about camel case in XML,
yeah,
you know, ironing out all of those things,
yeah, okay.
And we're down to the point where it looks identical. We'll see, you know, and it same HTTP verbs, posts and gets and okay. updates, and so we'll see how that works. But I'm pretty confident it's gonna work.
And I know you've also been looking at, am I right to think you've also been looking at putting new kinds of UI onto these services? We talked a little bit about UI with things like Silverlight.
Sure. So, the original reason for having an API, I mean, why build one, was that we could be sort of agnostic to the interface that was speaking to our own API. So we have, you know, Galaxy Zoo consumes its own API, or the website does. And, you know, moving to different type of UI, so you know, you can imagine having a Flash or Silverlight application also talking to the talking to the API. So the project we've been working with specifically with Microsoft has been actually a Silverlight UI embedded in a site that's again talking to our API layer. So.
Okay, cool. And that, am I right in thinking that's not something we could see just yet?
No, not quite.
All right,
it's very nearly here.
So you have to wait for that one?
You will.
All right, I'll wait for it and run it up as soon as you let me know you've got it.
Absolutely.
All right, thanks a lot for your time.
Yep.